Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Lucy Hawkins from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. The International Criminal Court is renewing investigations into alleged war crimes in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll hear from the court's deputy prosecutor.
We've been re-engaging with DRC the last few years, and our effort was geared toward defining and devising a response. The investigation that was left dormant are now being reactivated.
And a page on X, formerly Twitter, dedicated to showing a deterioration of basic infrastructure in Johannesburg over the years. And it's got people talking in South Africa. It's Thursday, October 17th. First, we go to Nigeria. Let's start with a story that's been in the news over the past 24 hours, where more than 150 people have died after a fuel tanker overturned late on Tuesday in Nigeria's northern state of Jigawa. The incident caused petrol to spill and many villagers rushed out to collect the fuel, but the spillage resulted in an explosion, killing most of those who were at the scene. 100 others were wounded and taken to local hospitals. Reports say that the driver lost control of the vehicle, causing it to tip over on a road en route from Kano State to Nguru Town in Yobe State. This is how local media has been reporting it.
This catastrophic inferno occurred around 10 p.m. when the residents of the area trooped out en masse to the accident scene to scoop fuel from the ill-fated tanker.
The incident is one of the worst in recent times in Africa's most populous nation, which is battling with widespread security threats and a cost of living crisis. Let's listen to reaction in the country.
It's unfortunate that it keeps happening. And it's as a result of bad roads, bad truck maintainers, bad policies that make these people feel like they don't have any other choice than to risk their life to get whatever little wall or whatever little thing they feel like they can get in that moment.
Most of the time, Nigerians are always going to see free fuel and think that it's an opportunity for them to make money, forgetting the fact that this is still an endangered situation.
When you put people in a tight situation, they will do drastic things. I think those people were not thinking about the fact that that is petrol, and petrol is flammable.
Florence Kayemba is the national director at the civil society group Stakeholder Democracy Network, based in Port Harcourt in the Niger Delta. What was her response to the news?
Oh my goodness, I don't know how to say this without sounding insensitive, but I'm going to just say it's another day, right? It's another day in Nigeria. It's another disaster. Another statistic, unfortunately. One too many, and you just start questioning, you know, what is the value of human life in Nigeria currently if you're woken up by all types of news every single day, and this to happen in Jigawa. It's very, very, very sad. These were obviously very needless deaths. One would have said that this could have been prevented, if anything, but it is what it is. It's a sorry state of affairs. And as usual, when incidents like these happen, people will come out, they'll condemn the government, they will start to give out recommendations. But guess what? Nobody's punished, nobody's prosecuted, nobody resigns, and life goes on until the next accident. And then there is such an uproar, there is such an outrage until something else happens. So yes, forgive me if I sound extremely cynical, but there have been one too many. I mean, there have been over 200 between 2021 and 2023. I think over 250 such incidents, which also include illegal oil refineries explosions within the Niger Delta. So the value of human life can be called into question as these incidents just continue reoccurring.
So it's happening too soon, too often rather. Why is that?
For me, I really believe it has a lot to do with one, regulation. What do I mean? It has to do with standards, enforcing standards. For example, a lot of the fuel tankers were actually meant to at least carry 30,000, I think, is it tons or gallons of fuel? I'm not sure of the metric used, but a lot of them go overboard. Secondly, the maintenance of these fuel tankers. Who ensures that when these incidents actually happen, that people get arrested or they get fined to the degree that it hurts their pockets so much? Because ask yourself, fine, the people who went to siphon the fuel, nobody sent them there. But we all know that if there is an explosion and you happen to be within that particular area, you will be affected. Is compensation ever given to the victims? Maybe some state governors will say, let's try and see how we can help the families. And that's just it. So one, poor regulation. Two, poor enforcement of the laws. Three, poor maintenance of vehicles. Four, some of these tankers are carrying fuel. They're carrying more fuel than they actually should. Five, the state of our roads is so bad within Nigeria in a number of places. And now that it's the rainy season, it's even worse. So that has also contributed to some of the issues with fuel tanker accidents. I'll give an example. In the Niger Delta, specifically in Rivers State, we have had strikes by the fuel tanker drivers. And they will tell you the reason why we're striking is because the roads are so bad. We're spending much more time on the roads. Our fuel tankers are actually getting damaged and nobody's giving us compensation. So you've had those sorts of incidents actually being reported. You've had those sorts of strikes. But, you know, as usual, nothing really happens. You know, life goes on. We come out and we condemn those who are responsible and then condole with those who've lost their loved ones. And that's just it. When these things happen, everybody blames the other.
Are you having any success in your engagement with government? Are you seeing any changes, policies coming on board to change the situation and reduce the risk?
I'm going to tell you something. You know, in Nigeria, there's so many vested interests, you know, from different parties. And I must be fair, especially to the federal government, they're always very willing to engage. However, just like in every other sector, enforcement is a challenge. This is not just peculiar to what it is we're talking about. And I guess why that becomes a challenge is that when it's just civil society organizations and not necessarily citizens rising up, holding people accountable within the government, it becomes a problem. So you have these engagements, you have all of this, but that public discourse that is sustained over a period of time, engaging with different parties and coming out with a blueprint is extremely important. They're very willing to engage with you, but as usual, it is always about the enforcement that is often a challenge.
We've seen the highest levels of the government in Nigeria commenting on this and the president reassuring the nation that something is going to be done. In this statement, he says that he reassures that the federal government will work with the state government and they are committed to the swift and comprehensive review of fuel transportation safety protocols across the country. Do you have faith that what the president is committing to is going to happen?
I think I'm one of those people who's overly optimistic, who still believes very much in Nigeria, who still believes that things can work in Nigeria. The president has said it, and as usual, we will wait and see what happens following that statement. With us, that's the way it is. You know, we try to keep hope alive. I mean, how many is too many? These conversations have been going on for many years. How do we transport fuel much more safely? What time should these fuel tankers move around, you know, the different cities so that we avoid these sorts of situations? How can this be enforced? But seeing is believing. So we will wait and see what actually happens. I think it's just been too much lip service over many years. It's really time for action to be taken.
Florence Kayimba is the National Director at the civil society group Stakeholder Democracy Network. It's based in the Niger Delta. In a statement, the Nigerian government has said the president, with a heavy heart, joins the vice president in extending his deepest condolences to the families of the victims of this devastating incident. And now to matters concerning the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the International Criminal Court prosecutor Karim Khan says that the organization is going to renew investigations into the country. We are using the word renew because the ICC has previously investigated crimes in the Congo between 2002 and 2004. The focus will now be on alleged crimes committed in North Kivu province since January 2022. The province has been plagued by conflict for more than two decades due to the presence of many armed groups, including the March 23rd Movement, M23. Over the past 2 years, fighting between the M23 and the Congolese army resumed, with the situation worsening since January 2024. According to reports, more than 1.5 million people have been forced to leave their homes since March 2022. The ICC prosecutor says these renewed efforts will aim to address allegations, including potential war crimes and crimes against humanity, and it will assess the responsibility of all parties involved without targeting specific groups. In a moment, we'll hear a reaction from the government in Kinshasa, but first, I've been finding out more from the ICC deputy prosecutor, Mam Majaye Niang.
The situation in DRC was a situation open following a referral we received in the early days of the life of the court, that was in 2004. So at the time, we, the Office of the Prosecutor and the court in general, we have had quite a few cases. But ever since, of course, what happened is that we've been re-engaging with DRC over the last few years. And our effort was geared toward defining and devising a response. That's why now we are communicating to indicate that the investigation that was left dormant are now being reactivated with now a team that has been set up to fully investigate.
So the statement from the Office of the Prosecutor said that the investigation will not be limited to specific parties, but are there interested groups that are of particular interest to this investigation that you're reopening?
When we start an investigation, I think that it is never helpful to start by pointing finger to specific groups or to specific person or to specific party in the conflict.
The reason why I'm also asking is because this is a conflict that another country has been mentioned. I'm sure you would be aware of this.
Yes,
that
yes,
the
definitely.
DRC government that has invited you to do the investigation has extensively accused Rwanda of providing military support and working with the M23 rebels in the eastern DRC, and Rwanda has denied these claims consistently. So I just want to understand the scope of your investigation in regards to that sense.
I think that the conclusion as to, or even the case theory as to who is involved, I think that the only response that will guide us to point finger would be the result of our own investigation.
And on the same matter, the government has invited your office to investigate these possible crimes in the country. But at the same time, you would be aware that human rights groups have reported that the government and the army and accused them of being heavy-handed in dealing with the rebels. And the government specifically is accused of being complicit in neglecting the plight of those living in the DRC. Could we anticipate that you would investigate the very government that has invited you to do this?
What I can tell you is that that's the real meaning of our independence. Because if we would allow ourselves only to look at where the fingers of government is pointing and the scope they would have already defined, I think that one would not be able to talk of independence. And we have made it clear, including to the DRC, that we will be at liberty to look at everything.
That's the ICC's deputy prosecutor, Mam Majaye Niang. So how has the government of the DRC responded to the news that ICC investigations will be carried out in its territory? Patrick Muyaya is the government spokesman.
It's a good news for the government because since 2002, the eastern part of DRC, especially North Kivu, we have those cycle of violence. And since that moment till today, there is no justice for all those people who've been suffering for the different acts of violence and criminality. This decision is like the result of the effort made by the head of state himself while he invited last year Mr. Karim Khan to speak about all those questions and to see the way ICC can open some investigation, especially for those violence we had in the eastern part of DRC.
So what are your thoughts then? Because the March 23rd movement, M23, are going to be a subject of this investigation.
Of course, they are the main responsible of violence, not only them, because they are working closely with Rwanda and different forces. All those people must be taken responsible of their respective acts. So we are hoping that the investigation will touch all those people because we have names. And even if some of the Rwandan officers, we have their names and they will see what will be the coming out of the investigation. We are happy to start this process finally.
I must say that they have denied the government of Rwanda such claims and they are not presently here during this interview to defend that point. But tell us how this investigation, in your view, is going specifically to focus on the activities of Rwanda. How is that being approached?
We know that Rwandan people keep lying on that. They never recognize, but there is a lot of report made every 6 months by United Nations group of experts. And the last one was explaining the way more than 40,000 Rwandan military are operating in the east part of DRC. M23 doesn't exist. It's Rwanda acting with those proxies. So today, this investigation must be go deeper on that. There is a lot of report internally in the country. There is some of the report made by United Nations group of experts. There is a lot of proof that can be used by the International Criminal Court to make sure they have all information and during the investigation, they can be able to find some responsible of those different actors.
But in the course of this investigation, will it be touching on the Congolese army as well? Because according to Human Rights Watch, I'll quote a report that they released in September, they say that both sides, and in this case, they talked about M23 and also the Congolese army, have killed and raped residents, and this happened specifically in Goma. So is there a chance that your military is also going to get investigated for the activities in that part of the country?
One thing is clear here, that the President Tshisekedi is really committed to justice. All those are involved on these different cases must be taken to justice, especially even if our military are involved on those kind of crimes. Of course, there must be investigation and they have to be taken responsible of that.
And while I had Patrick on the line, I wanted to ask about another development we've seen in the headlines. You see, for the past few months, Angola has been mediating talks between Rwanda and the DRC, which, as you just heard, are pretty frosty at the moment. Earlier this week, Angola put out some information saying an agreement has been reached, but there was no confirmation from either Kigali or Kinshasa. So I asked Patrick about it.
The deal wasn't signed yet, but there is a continuing process of discussion involving first a technical expert and then at ministerial level. The final point must be normally head of state want to really agree on what we should do in different parts to make sure the pieces come back. There was conversation between both governments following the conversation we had on September 14, because we as DRC, our position is clear. We agree that we need to neutralize those remaining FDLR inside our territory because Rwanda is using that as protect to continue these bad activities in DRC. At the same time, Rwanda should remove his military and all materials they put in DRC. So I think the mediation spoke with both parties. Now they are waiting the position of what we call in French CONOPS, like an operation plan, which will be able at the same time to work with Congolese and Rwanda to make sure we are respecting what we agree on and to move progress to peace.
Would you then say that following that meeting and, you know, the commitments to neutralize the FDLR, would you say all this is a step forward in resolving these long-running tensions between the two countries?
Of course, because Rwanda keeps using that as a pretext. So we just want to make sure that everything is outside, that the peace came back, because we have this very bad humanitarian situation with more than 7 million people displaced inside the country, but especially more than 1.5 million for this crisis since Rwanda started to act on the eastern part of DRC. This must be stopped.
Patrick Muyaya is the spokesman for the DRC government. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I'm Lucy Hawkins from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories, and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation, and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
In recent years, South Africans have become accustomed to dealing with the country's infrastructure challenges, from rolling blackouts to crumbling roads and hijacked buildings. However, a new debate has emerged online about the state of South Africa's urban centers, and it began with a viral thread on X titled Josie vs. Josie. The thread highlights the rapid deterioration of Johannesburg's streets, buildings, and parks. Let me describe it to you. A typical post in the thread shows two side-by-side images of the same location in the same city. One shows a clean street bustling with pedestrians in front of a well-maintained shopfront 10 or 15 years ago, compared with the same place in 2024, which shows a dug-up sidewalk, piles of trash bags, and debris scattered around a rundown building. This thread has gained over 30,000 followers in just 2 weeks and ignited a debate in South Africa about the neglect of urban areas across the country. I've been chatting to long-time resident of Johannesburg, Firdoz Bulbulia, an activist and filmmaker who's been talking to me about the hopes and dreams in post-apartheid South Africa and the complexity of this story.
For us as citizens of Johannesburg, it is a concern, of course. But politically, I come from the old activist South Africa, those of us who fought for a new South Africa. So in a way, we're caught in the middle, because there's a part of us that wants to understand why it is as it is. And there's a part of us that wants to know that we are actually looking at what the challenges are and what these have been post-apartheid and kind of into the new democracy. So my take is really, how do we have a nuanced conversation about what the issues are? And in terms of what is happening in the infrastructure development in South Africa, and maintenance in particular, that's really where the concerns lie.
I've been to this page myself on X, and it's images, you know, pictures that are sourced from maybe 2010, 2013, of a road or a certain part of infrastructure. And next to that image is the current state, or maybe an image from last year, and you can sort of see the difference. You can see perhaps the street was cleaner in 2010 than it is now, or the traffic light was in a better condition than it is now. As a resident, are these things that you're seeing in the city?
Yes, of course, this is what is happening. The kind of the deterioration within the city is immense and is a concern. I, in fact, was going to take some pictures of my home for you to actually see that I now have a water tanker, which in all of my life, I am 62 years old. I never imagined that I would need to have my own source of water. So, yes, there is a huge concern, you know, especially at the municipality level. We don't necessarily have the best people doing the job that needs to be done. There's also a concern, of course, that maintenance hasn't taken place over a very long period. And then I would say, coming more from a political perspective, is that you have an influx of people from all over the country, but also from other parts of the continent who have moved to particularly Johannesburg because it was always seen as the city of gold. And what does that mean, you know, when you have so many people living together? There will be a constraint on all of these facilities and amenities.
You've lived in Johannesburg for a long time. When you see these buildings, these roads, what goes through your mind?
I think that, you know, the changes have happened over a long period. So we are 30 years into democracy. And gradually things have changed. Of course, now it seems almost as if it's happened overnight. There is definitely a sense of concern. We think that some of these buildings are hijacked anyway by unscrupulous people, whether they are landlords or subdivisions or whatever might have happened. I think in terms of the road infrastructure, you would have seen or heard about, you know, areas where roads have just sunken in, particularly in communities of people who are struggling, where things are really tough in the inner city, trying to eke out a living, whether they're hawkers on the street, and their roads have collapsed. But there is also what has happened. There's a kind of vigilante group that's coming. There's also a group who are using and abusing the situation and making life difficult for everybody. I think that there is a disappointment because we are not expecting this from what we call a world-class African city. And so what are we doing to ensure that the infrastructure and maintenance is actually taking place? And unfortunately, because we have so much infighting amongst politicians, the work that needs to be done is not happening. And I think what we would have wanted and hoped was that, you know, politicians can fight on one level, but officials and people who are supposed to be doing the work of the municipalities, that should continue.
Talking about politicians and leaders, I mean, the city has had many different parties in charge, mm-hmm. not just the African National Congress. Had anyone at any point tried to fix the infrastructure or at least keep it in good operating condition?
I think depending on where you sit, you would have different politicians and political parties saying that they have tried. For us as residents and citizens of South Africa, we look from the outside in and we say, well, nothing's happened. You are so busy fighting each other that you are dropping the ball. Political parties, depending on, as I said, who they are, will say, oh, well, we're trying. But I think their concentration, unfortunately, is really on servicing themselves and making sure, you know, that the focus is not really on the infrastructure and the development.
And how are people talking about that, what you've just described, that the politicians are busy, but the infrastructure is collapsing?
I think people are angry. I think there are different communities of people responding differently. I'm part of a WhatsApp group of Africans from the diaspora who feel targeted, who feel that they are not really impacting the infrastructure, but are being blamed for issues where the infrastructure is not working, for the deterioration in the inner city. So I think there are different kinds of conversations. For people who are at government level, you would hear them saying that, look, the maintenance has not happened over a long period, so it is really difficult for us to go back and fix some of what is happening, and that takes time. And you will also find that politically, apartheid communities and townships and areas have been demarcated for decades. You know, I live in the north, the northern suburbs, so I'm relatively okay. But if I just go across the road, across the bridge, is Alexandra community, where you have such a small kind of densely populated area and people are struggling for water, basic human rights.
If you were to describe for us what you saw maybe 20, 15 years ago in Johannesburg and now, how would you describe that in terms of the main differences that you see?
I think it's vastly different. I go down to the Market Theatre very often, and driving through the city at dusk felt like I was in some kind of dystopian environment. It felt like a movie. Not only that, we were then attacked and somebody was trying to steal our car keys as we were driving. So you can imagine somebody alongside you trying to hijack your car as you stop in at a robot. So it was a shock to me because these were spaces we inhabited. We walked from Fordsburg, where I grew up, down to Newtown, where the Market Theatre is. You know, it was like a 10-minute walk or a half an hour stroll. And suddenly that's not possible anymore. It's a shock.
because that's not what we were hoping for. We were hoping that into democracy, life will be easier. There will be opportunity for everybody. We will be there to support each other. But that hasn't happened. People don't go out at night. The theaters are shut. People who come from other cities, you know, I had friends who came from Cairo where it's buzzing, you know, throughout the day and night. They actually called and said, is there a problem in Cape Town? I said, why? They said, well, it's so quiet. It's quiet because people stay home.
So it's not just Johannesburg then. It's also happening in other cities in the country.
Oh, absolutely. Somebody said to me the other day that if you're driving to Brits, which is in the Northwest province, or if you're driving in the Eastern Cape, the potholes are even worse. You know, I wondered how that could happen. But that is true. If I drive from the airport back into the northern suburbs, on many occasions, there are no lights. There's no power. There's no electricity. And I live between South Africa, Nigeria. My husband is Nigerian, and the UK. And I see vastly the difference. So, you know, when we used to drive through Lagos, from the airport into where our hotel was, it was almost accepted that, okay, there wouldn't be lights. But now for me to drive from OR Tambo into Sandton and there are no lights on the highway, it's a surprise, it's a shock, and it's really unsettling.
What needs to be done, Firdoz, as we close? What can authorities do to address these infrastructure challenges?
Without being intellectual about it, without just talking about it, I think it is about shifting minds, about saying to people, you know, who are you as an African? How do you tell your story? Thabo Mbeki's father, Governor Mbeki, said to us once when we interviewed him, he said, what kind of a people allow their story to be told by others? And he qualified it, he said, by whites. Because in the context of South Africa, there was a certain narrative that was told. And so for us as progressive South Africans, we are disappointed to see what is happening. And part of it is that we want to tell a different story. Part of it is we say to the people who represent us, this is not who we are. You need to shift. You need to change. You need to take care. So what can we do? We need good leadership. And leadership comes from information, from struggle, from education, from training. And that's what we need to do. It is disappointing for me, 30 years into democracy. And this is a physical thing. You know, we can say people are disappointed, people are frustrated, but you physically see a hole in a road. You physically see there's no lights. You physically see the taps are dry. That is a concern because that should not happen. Not into a wealthy country like South Africa, because we are a wealthy country. Our people should not be living under these difficult circumstances.
All right. Thank you very much, Firdoz, for your time and your thoughts. Very, very interesting listening to you.
Thank you, Charles. Thanks.
Firdoz Bulbulia is a filmmaker and activist living in Johannesburg. We have approached the Johannesburg municipality for a right of reply, and we are awaiting a response from them. Focus on Africa was put together by Rob Wilson, Joseph Keane, Yvette Twagira Maria, Victor Silva, and Benjamin Woodruff in London. Blessing Adiruba did her bit from Lagos. Connie Sharp was the senior journalist in charge of the program, and Francesca Dan was the technical producer. Our editors are Andrew Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. Many thanks for listening.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories, and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation, and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.